The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This week, we've been listening to some of the highlights from the New Yorker Festival, where my colleague Susan Morrison recently sat down with John Hamm. Now, Mad Men has been over for more than 2 years, but it's going to take a lot longer than that for John Hamm to shake the character of Don Draper, the quintessential old-school man's man, if we can say that anymore. Draper was the strong, silent type. He's tall, dark, handsome, he keeps his secrets close, and he drinks alone. And one thing Don Draper was not too often, was funny. And for John Hamm, getting out from under all that manly baggage has meant taking parts that make fun of his Draper mystique and play up his own comic side. And here he is with the New Yorker's Susan Morrison.
Let's talk for a minute about the origin story of your comedy geekness. You lost your mother when you were 10, and
which is hilarious.
No, it's not funny, but...
See?
Yeah. And had a kind of a difficult, unconventional childhood, which led you to watch a lot of comedies.
Yes.
So why don't you
I'm kind of a weird only child hybrid. My dad was married once before my mom, and he had two daughters with his first wife, who were my half-sisters. And then he married my mom, and they got divorced when I was two. And so my mom kind of raised me till I was 10. So I was an only child-ish. And then when my mom passed away, I moved in with my dad. One of my sisters was living with him at the time. The other one had gotten married and moved out. And again, this is before the internet existed. So you had to like read books and listen to albums and cassette tapes and go to the library to figure out, to really get anything. We happened to live next to a university. They had an awesome library. So I would go to the library a lot and check out comedy records and, just devour anything I could. That's where I first started reading Spy magazine. You know, that was how you consumed culture, sort of. And I was a big, right. I was just like, that's what I wanted to do. I loved laughing. I loved when my dad would let me stay up late enough to watch Saturday Night Live in the 70s when I was way too young to be watching things like that. I sought it out and kind of went and tried to find it where I could.
So what were the records? Were you listening to like Albert Brooks and Fireside Theater?
Yeah, and the Monty Python, which again, that was the only way you could really see it.
Yeah.
Bob Newhart, I mean, George Carlin, Richard Pryor. But yeah, anything I could get my hands on. There's something about like, yeah, I was a latchkey kid. Yeah. I would come home, I had babysitters all the time, and the one cool babysitter that I had, if my mom went out on a Saturday night, would be like, hey, can we stay up and watch Saturday Night Live? And I look back and I was like, my babysitter was like a 13-year-old boy.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Like, wait a minute. This guy's in charge? Different times, the 80s, 70s.
After college, you went back and you taught at your high school, which you mentioned, and you also worked in daycare, which is very sweet.
I worked at a daycare in college, and the reason I did was twofold. One, being the son of a single mom, I was in daycare basically from when I was like five on, all the time. And I loved it. It was really fun because you got to be around a bunch of other kids. So it was like I had siblings or whatever. It was like super fun and very structured, very cool. But there were no guys. There were no like male teachers. It was a very female kind of situation. And I was like, that's lame. Like there should be dude teachers too. And secondly, I it was also the kind of the only job I could do in college because I had classes during the day and I had play rehearsals at night. So I couldn't be like a waiter or a bartender or anything because that was all at night. And I couldn't do anything like 9-to-5 job because I had class. So I had literally had this like 3-to-6 window. And I was like, that sounds like an after school program kind of thing. And I pitched this idea to this little old lady who ran, named Pat, who ran a daycare place called Kids Depot. Not kidding. It had like a little red train sign. Kids Depot. Weird if you don't think too hard on it. It's not great. But I worked there for like 2 years and it was fantastic. And it felt nice to be able to kind of be that person that I didn't have in my life. And that's why I went back and taught at Burroughs, John Burroughs, where I went to school, is because I felt like the school had given so much to me. I wasn't in the position to write a big check and endow some scholarship, which I've done since.
Is there a John Hamm Hall now?
There isn't, but there is a scholarship endowed in my mom's name, and the first recipient of that just graduated last year, and he wants to be an actor.
Aww.
And there is a black box theater named after my first acting teacher who recently retired. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah, those are the two big things that I've done. And
So when you moved to LA after that, it took you a while to really break through, right? I mean, you were 36 when you were cast in Mad Men, and you were working before then, but it was spotty, right? What characterized that period of time for you?
35 when I was cast in Mad Men. I'll take care of what I can get at this point. I moved out to LA when I was 25. So my kind of guiding principle was, look, I don't want to be that guy who's waiting tables, losing hair, 40 years old, 3 credits on his resume, still calls himself an actor, and is just trying to hold it together.
Yeah.
I can do that anywhere. So I gave myself 5 years. I was like, a lot can happen in 5 years. And positive and negative. And if that's a pretty fair amount of time to really kind of give yourself a chance to figure out the city, figure out how it all works, what's it gonna be, and really kind of give yourself a fair shot. So I was like, if I turn 30 and I don't, and I'm still, you know, kind of waiting tables or whatever, then I'll just pack it up and I'll go do something else.
Right.
You know, the market has spoken, so to speak. And let's not kid ourselves. Like, acting is, especially now, less so, a little bit less so then, but especially now, is a young person's game, mm-hmm. basically. And fortunately enough, I happened to turn 30 on the set of my first film that I ever did. It was called We Were Soldiers. And then literally after that, the fall after that, I got my first regular part on a series, mm-hmm. a show called The Division, which I'm sure you all watched. There's going to be a quiz. That was on the Lifetime Television Network. About 5 lady cops and me.
Well, when Mad Men hit, when you were 35, it created a frenzy. I mean, I remember that year being in a subway car on Halloween, being surrounded by... 50 drunk Jones and Dons. You know, I mean, it was just a frenzy. And there are all kinds of explanations aside from just the goodness and quality of the show about what that, you know, why it created that kind of stir. What's your theory?
First of all, there was really nothing like our show. I mean, it had its elements of things that I think people could recognize, but it stood out in a way that was very helpful in separating it from what at that point was sort of an explosion of TV. And I mean, since then, we've had an even more, a double explosion of TV. But that was kind of the first one where it was always HBO and Showtime. They were doing their prestige television. But then in 2005 or whatever, the other networks started to do cool shows and promote them as cool shows. And they were cool shows. And they got important movie stars to be in them. And ours was different. It was a show that had buzz and a show that was intelligent and it didn't talk down to its audience and it was cryptic and it was weird and it was slow and it was all these different things that people kind of didn't really know what to do with it, but they knew it was different. And And people talked about it. And it, I think, not for nothing, coincided with the advent of the iPhone. Yeah. And with blog culture and recap culture.
So viral.
What started to happen, our show certainly wasn't the first, but people started just writing blogs and pieces and think pieces about the show. And it had this outsized kind of cultural footprint that nobody watched it, but people loved to talk about it. And I mean, that's what it was. And it was a very interesting experience to go through that because, you know, the show sort of won awards and things out of the gate. So we knew we were a hit, but there was always the, but no one watches it. The first season, our advertisers were like boner pills and that headache medicine that you put directly on your forehead. And season two, it was Mercedes-Benz and Heineken. So we were like, somebody's watching, and they're really rich. So that's kind of when we realized, like, oh, wow, like, this is happening.
We have a little Mad Men clip we'll take a look at.
I hate dating. Terrible at it.
You'll find someone. You know you're cute as hell.
Men don't exactly stop and stare in the streets.
Do you want that?
It's not what you were supposed to say.
What do you care what I think?
Oh. Everybody thinks I slept with you to get the job. They joke about it. Like it's so funny because the possibility was so remote.
It's not because you aren't attractive. I have to keep rules about work. I have to. You're an attractive girl, Peggy.
Not as attractive as some of your other secretaries, I guess.
You don't want to start giving me morality lessons, do you? People do things, right?
What's Lizzie Moss been up to?
Do you feel like playing a character like Don Draper costs you anything emotionally? I mean, is it corrosive to play a terrible person convincingly?
Yes and no. I think it is hard to be in that headspace 24/7, but I'm not the kind of person that takes stuff home with them. Mm-hmm. You know, part of it was just taking off the suit and taking all that out of my hair. Felt, you know, sort of redemptive in some way or cleansing in some way. And then you go home, you know, and you live your life. But it's hard. Part of it, navigating what the show became and navigating the success and all that stuff is the trickiest part of it. The work is great. The work is what you want to do. It's navigating the rest of it, especially now. I don't know. I mean, maybe it wasn't as hard before there was TMZ and social media and all this other garbage, but like, it's that's the challenge.
Mad Men was just such a career-defining role. I wonder if your whole acting life post Mad Men is sort of a reaction against Mad Men.
No, I think not necessarily. The fun thing for an actor is to be able to do different stuff. And so it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to react against and play the opposite, but I definitely wanted to just do different things. And so when, for example, Tina Fey decides, okay, hey, you want to be on 30 Rock? That's different.
Yeah, I'd like to do that.
That's kind of fun. For me, the fun part of doing what I do is doing things that are a little bit risky, make you feel a little bit uncomfortable. And, and I've certainly been guilty of doing a lot of those things. So.
Well, one of the great things about the combination of an indelible character like Don Draper and your comic skills is that you've done a lot of wonderful, what you could call comic send-ups, in a way, of the Don Draper type. I'm thinking of your role in Bridesmaids. Why don't we look at that clip?
Oh, God.
Which I love.
You slept over.
I did.
I thought we had a rule against that. Oh.
I'm kidding.
Oh. That was funny. You're funny in the morning.
But I like hanging out with you.
Oh, yeah. I love hanging out with you. I think we get along really well, and you're so sexy and...
I know. I just, you know, I just have a lot coming up at work, and I don't want to make promises I can't keep. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I know you do.
Yeah. We're on the same page. I mean, I'm not looking for a relationship right now either. Let's just say that. I just, whatever you want to... I can do, you know, I'd rather just, I like simple, not like other girls where I'm like, be my boyfriend. Unless you were like, yeah. Then I'd be like, maybe. I don't want that either.
Wow, this is so awkward. I really want you to leave, but I don't know how to say that. Like the
oh.
You guys have such great chemistry together. It's really funny.
That is a very weird thing to say about that scene.
I mean, comic chemistry. Now, was this before or after you and Kristen Wiig did a lot of great stuff together on Saturday Night Live?
It was after. Kristen and I knew each other fairly well by this point, and she had come to me and said, Annie and I wrote this great movie, and we're really excited. We really want you to be in it. And I was like, cool. I was like, well, you know, I'm kind of doing this show. I don't have a ton of time. And she's like, we wrote a part for you. And I was like, I read it. And I was like, the first three pages are like, we're just like, it's a big sex scene. I was like, Kristen.
Now, Tina Fey is famous for saying once that John Hamm was so handsome that she wanted to poke a hole through a paper plate and look at him through it like she was looking at an eclipse.
She actually said that in front of me, too. And I was
she like, did?
What is wrong with you? I'm right here. How
so,
dare you?
Thank you all. Thank you all for coming, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Putting on the suit and...
It's so late.
And everything else.
John Hamm at the New Yorker Festival in October 2017 with the New Yorker's Susan Morrison.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.